On this week's 51%, hooping, swimming.
I swam across the English Channel at the age of 44 in 9 hours and 5 minutes, and it was the fastest time that year.
And dancing. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Hula hoop, hula hoop. Everyone is playing with the hula hoop. Look at them spin, trying to win. Anyone can play from 3 to 110.
Sometimes finding an activity that brings us joy can make us happy and healthier. Bernadette King discovered hula hooping and found joy and a better, stronger body. Now, though, she's struggling to recapture that joy as well as her health. Shannon Moffitt from the Transom Traveling Workshop and WDET reports.
There's this video. It's only a few seconds long, but it makes me smile every time I see it. In it, there's a group of people hula hooping.
Hands in the air. Call me.
Leading the crowd is Bernadette King, the queen.
Oh, that's what they call me, the queen of hula hoop.
Bernadette lives in the Fitzgerald neighborhood of Detroit. She got her first hula hoop a decade ago as a gift from a boyfriend. He's gone, but the hoops have multiplied. She uses so many that last summer she started making them herself using tubing from Home Depot. She bends it and crimps it, then she wraps each hoop in colored tape so they look like candy.
So these are all different sizes. These are the children's hula hoops because they're a little bit smaller. These are the largest hula hoops that I have, and those are for full-figured women.
Bernadette got so into hooping that she started taking her hoops to work with her. There's a photo on her wall.
That's me, hula hooping, and Henry Ford. We have recess. So I was just out there hula hooping with some people.
On her days off, she went to the park and took extra hoops with her, just to share her love of hula hooping with anyone who passed by.
There's men and women, boys and girls that like to hula hoop. There's a lot of seniors that like to hula hoop and can hula hoop. Once I fit them with the right hoop, oh, they're good to go.
And Bernadette, she got really good at it.
Sometimes I hoop with 2 hoops around my waist, sometimes 2 hoops around my hands. I've done up to 3 or 4 hoops around my waist.
Pretty soon, she was hooping more than an hour a day.
Oh, I must have lost about 20 pounds that summer.
Pounds she'd been struggling to shed since she was a teenager.
I remember I liked this boy. I had a crush on a boy. And I think somebody said he thought that I was cute, but I was a little pudgy. I was a little overweight. So I've done Weight Watchers, I fasted, I've done it all.
But then,
when I combined hula hooping with swimming, oh, it was on. I was very healthy and strong.
Now, I think maybe if we go this way.
Today, though, she's leaning on a stainless steel cane, the kind with 4 little feet at the bottom.
Let's fly, and then a few more steps. Okie dokie.
By the time we'd climbed the stairs and settled in the empty apartment above hers, there were beads of sweat on Bernadette's nose and forehead. It's been 4 months since she was able to hula hoop.
This summer, it was just one of the hardest summers that I've ever had. And one day I woke up and my legs and my calves were just unbelievably sore, just stiff.
It got worse.
I remember I wasn't cooking. I could hardly clean the house. When I would get home from work, I would just come in the house and that was it.
She tried rest. She tried physical therapy. She tried cortisone shots. But eventually, she had to see a surgeon. 8 weeks ago, he operated on her back. Bernadette says the surgery has given her some relief, but still.
Pain is just, there's nothing worse than pain. Pain is the worst thing. And I don't know, if it wasn't for hula hooping, I don't know. The only thing I had to look forward to was hula hooping. It was just the one thing that just kept me going. And I just prayed that, you know, I could go out there and have fun. And if it turns out that I can't, then I'll still help other people to hula hoop.
Shall I try?
Yep. Okay. So what I'll show you first is how to properly hand hoop.
The hand hoop is wrapped in pink and green and black tape. It looks like it's made from a stick of fancy licorice, and it's tiny, maybe 18 inches across. This mini hoop is for what hula hoopers call an off-body move, where the hoop is going on my hand instead of my waist.
Okay. Hand hoop is really easy. When I get tired,
like after a major operation,
I hand hoop. And this is the basic move right here.
Oh, my God.
Uh-oh. Okay, let me give you room.
All right, yeah. I'm going to need a lot of room.
Uh-huh. Oh. Okay, bring it back.
Eventually, whether because of my clumsiness or the irresistibility of hooping, Bernadette decides to show me how.
I'm getting in the groove here.
It's only hand hooping after all, so she won't need to bend her back.
So this is the basic move right there. Going on there.
Wait, how are you even doing that? That's defying gravity. That thing, your arm is facing straight down to the ground, but it's not falling off.
Mm-mm, because I'm twirling it around my hand.
This is the first time Bernadette has hula hooped since her surgery.
You can go like this.
Uh-huh.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun. You can stand there and just twirl it. Then you can move out.
For the Transom Traveling Workshop and WDET in Detroit, I'm Shannon Moffitt.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews solo marathon swimmer Liz Fry. Fry is the oldest individual, at age 60, male or female, to achieve the Ocean 7. This marathon swimming challenge consists of 7 open water swims, including the North Channel, the Cook Strait, the Molokai Channel, the English Channel, the Catalina Channel, the Sugaro Strait, and the Strait of Gibraltar. She is the 17th swimmer ever to accomplish this challenge. Up for Gaspry to share her story.
So I was born in New York City. You could probably hear that. My family moved out to Long Beach, Long Island, which because of the strong surf there and my parents' love for the beach, they signed us all up for swim lessons. I'm one of 5 kids. So about when I was about 5 years old, my brother and sisters were already on the swim team. I was dying to be on the swim team, but I was tiny. So my mom would have to come with me and swim in a separate lane. And eventually the coach gave up and waived the height requirement and allowed me to join the swim team. So that's where I was in New York. And then we really embraced it. And by the time I was 7, 8 years old, we were up at swim camps. We went to a swim camp up in Canada, about 4 hours north of Toronto. So you can imagine when we left school in June, there was still ice on those lakes. So we would get there. And the thing that always struck me, and I'll come back to this later, they had a mess tent that was full of walls of Olympians and great swimmers, all just beautiful pictures of everybody. And then in this tiny little corner was about 4 or 5 pictures of swimmers covered with white grease, with crazy-looking swim masks, because goggles hadn't been invented yet, standing in the dark, getting ready to walk into cold, murky waters. And it looked so scary, but super cool to my, like, 7-year-old self. And so those photos always, you know, stayed in my mind, you know. And so it's probably up in, you know, icy lakes in Canada that I fell in love with open water swimming.
You know, you were inspired by pictures, you know, when you were just a little girl. But then, listen, I know you have a day job as a global bank strategy consultant, which sounds like mm-hmm. a big, important job. But it sounds like this swimming, you know, as you got older, the swimming kind of took over all of your motivation. Talk to me a little bit about when you kind of made the transition into this, you know, serious marathon swimming life.
Okay, yeah. So for me, as you expect, as most swimmers do, they swim through high school and college. I started working and really stopped swimming for many years until, like, I was in my, maybe I say many years, 25, and I joined a local master's team. And, you know, they were swimming. They, you know, people were still swimming in the pool. And then they would have the local town 1-mile swim, which seemed like an enormous, really long swim out in Long Island Sound. And now, of course, 1 mile sounds like a sprint, but, you know, then it was a challenging long distance. So I'm working. I actually, before I started marathon swimming, I got into marathon running, and that was more because of my job. As you mentioned, my job had me traveling a lot, so I had little time for a pool. But it was when my mom passed away in 1991 of cancer that I realized how much exercise was so important to managing, stress in general. And this, the sadness, I think that it was a good release. So I started running, and I ran 15 marathons. And, I always think these things are one and done, and that doesn't happen. So I was running, and then I ended up I took a position down. It was supposed to be short-term down in Baltimore. So that's how I got into marathon swimming. I stayed with friends, and the person I stayed was an age group swimmer that I swam with as an 11-year-old up in Connecticut. And I started swimming with her group. And in 2000, a few members of the group decided they wanted to apply to do an English Channel relay. And they needed another member to fill out their 6-person team. So in 2001, I swam in the English Channel and was completely in awe. And I say that with, there's also something very heartfelt. My father was British, and I will tell you, from the time I was, I can remember, he always talked about the English Channel and that, if you really, really were a swimmer, you would swim the English Channel. It was at the Mount Everest of swimming. So to have swum on this English Channel relay was really kind of the big step. And what I then decided that I had so much fun that I wanted to try it as a solo. So I came back and started training in Long Island Sound and with a friend who was actually doing an attempt in 2002 for his channel swim. So the end of it in 2003 with my sister Peggy as crew chief and my English first cousin as crew, I swam across the English Channel at the age of 44. And 9 hours and 5 minutes, and it was the fastest time that year. And probably the best part of that swim was that my dad was with me in Dover. And he passed away in 2004, but I did get to swim the English Channel while he was still alive.
You know, when you say this, you say it as if it was not that big a deal that you swam by yourself at age 44 for 9 hours across the English Channel. I mean, most people wouldn't ever accomplished such an enormous feat. But 2 years later, then you came back to the U.S. and swam the Catalina Channel, right?
That's right. That's right. And again, I come back to that. Catalina was was really what helped me get through my father's passing, was having that ability to train and be with people. And I tend to swim sort of a dynamic meditation. And so I can, I find that kind of happy place to get to. And, just it really does help me, get through a lot of the stuff that life takes you through.
No, so I'm just so curious, I think often people find an exercise that helps them through a trying time. But what was the motivation to achieve this level of accomplishment at this time in your life? Here you are in your 40s and 50s, and you're trying to achieve something that very few people in the world have even attempted. Can you give me a little insight into why you felt you wanted to take on this kind of a challenge?
I'd love to. So for me, what I've loved throughout this and what motivates me is really the journey. Really, the swims are fantastic. They're in these wonderful waters, blue, sometimes dark, sometimes scary, all those things that kind of bring you out of your comfort zone in terms of the swim. But the life that I've had over the last, almost 15, 16 years of taking on this from 44 and now I'm 61, has been so enriched by the people I've met and the places I've seen, the cultures that I've experienced, and just the community itself and the support I receive, and more importantly, the success that I have enjoyed with other people when they do their swims has just been phenomenal. So, for me, that's the motivation. It's and I don't even know that it's the swim. It's the joy of experiencing the world in a very different way.
That's beautiful. I know that you are only one of six women to have completed this Ocean 7 channel crossing accomplishment. And I'm just wondering, what are you doing now? I mean, what, here you've accomplished something that only 17 people in the world, let alone only six women. What's next? Do you have new goals? What are you doing?
I do. I have really, it's funny because my goals are usually more that there's a place or there are people that I would love to see. So my most current, I would say, is right now I'm back in the pool swimming and so I'm training. So swimming wise, my current goal is to finish up the Great Lakes, and it's really a tribute to my love of Canada and where it all began. I've already completed the Lake Ontario and Lake Huron, and so I'm hoping to be able to attempt Lake Superior this summer. It gets complicated with the logistics of arranging for pilots and things like that. It's not a swim that has a bank of pilots that you can call and say, hey, will you take me across Lake Superior? And there's some other swims I have on my bucket list, and more about places I want to go and people that I've met through this journey, who said, they say, come to Sea of Galilee. It's a beautiful swim. And why wouldn't I want to do that? Why wouldn't I want to see Israel and swim in this beautiful body of water? I'm very lucky to have the swimming to really be my transport in some ways to these wonderful experiences.
I know you mentioned to me earlier that you're actually not slowing down at all and that you're swimming faster than you were swimming 10 years ago. How is that possible?
It's true. I had to, I knew there's Cook Strait is a very, of the seven oceans is a challenging swim. And in particular, it's the currents at the end are very, very strong. So I knew besides being strong, I needed speed, get back that strong and fast, or faster to make Cook Strait. So I trained last two years to really work on speed and swimming with friends in the pool that are faster than me and will push me. And that's what you need to do. You need to move out of the lane that you love and that you're comfortable in and move to the next lane and push yourself to, faster intervals and with faster people and people, less rest and all those things, at least in the pool, and people can relate with other things that they might do. But it's always, stepping out of one lane and going into one that's scary to really kind of challenge yourself and kind of get to that next place that you need to do to be.
I know that you're very inspirational to so many other swimmers and that you actually help others with their own training for long swims, which is so such a beautiful thing when you're in a sport like that. I would love to know what advice you have for other women who want to achieve something so extraordinary.
Yeah, I think, the most important thing is what I did was, when you have a goal, you say it out loud with conviction. The moment I said I wanted to attempt to swim the English Channel, kind of the whistle blew and the train started pulling out of the station. So you really need to say it out loud. It can't be something that you're thinking about, but say it out loud and it will start to come to reality. The other thing I think is research and ask for help. Make a plan. Find others that share your passion. Create a support community. Get training buddies. Those are always great. For me, I had oftentimes I didn't have swimmers that I could swim with out, in Long Island Sound, but I would have a friend come and read a book on the beach. At least I knew I wasn't exactly alone. There was safe, safety. But and they became part of my success, and my success is only based on the people that is only because I have all these people that have supported me. But you can't do a swim like this or take on a challenge without having that.
And then I already mentioned this. I think that a big thing is be brave and get out of your comfort zone, whether it's, you know, facing open water for the first time or starting to train with people who are faster or more than experienced. And everybody wants to help each other, especially, and I can say this for the open water swimming community, but I think it's true in every endeavor. You know, so ask questions, share your experiences, give back and help others. But I think probably the one thing I would say was the thing that I think that will keep you grounded with anything is keep your life balance. I think having your friends and family, you know, remember that they're your most important assets. Like my sister's been on almost every one of my swims. And just remember that it's about the journey and not the swim.
Thank you so much, Liz. We're going to be watching you and looking and listening and seeing what else is on the horizon for you. It's so exciting and so inspirational. That was Liz Fry, marathon swimmer extraordinaire. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. Next, we meet Deja Joel.
Everybody has dance experience. That experience when you heard your favorite song and you start grooving in your seat. What do you feel at your core and how do you put that from the inside outside? That's dance. I'm Deja Joel, interdisciplinary artist, dancer based in traditional West African movement. I'm also a healer. Right now, I'm developing my own dance technique and aesthetic that promotes self-love and self-care, healing from generational traumas to any type of emotional harm or traumas that have been done inside of your body. I don't believe in actual performance. I believe in observance. I believe that when you dance, it's for you and it's not for anyone else. You shouldn't be pretending to be sad or pretending to be euphoric, but actually being that and being in your body. My dance company is named Black, B-L-A-Q, all caps, not an acronym. It's composed of five Black women who are unapologetically themselves. There's four pillars of Black, which is writing, discussion, dance, and American Sign Language. So each member of Black is required to learn sign language. We have an ASL brunch once a month where we all bring food and we learn ASL. Sign language is a really big part of my life. It just deepened my movement vocabulary. And I realized that my face played a big role in how I move. You dance with your face, how you relate to things with your hands, and also to make the movement more accessible because it's a visual language. It's really about self-discovery and discovering what your body can do, what your body likes, what your body dislikes. And when we talk about the dance world, usually it becomes competition-like, and it's usually ballet-based, very Eurocentric ways of dancing in which my body, which is a big bone, thick body, does not conform into, cannot fit into. So it wasn't until I met Kenna Cotman, who was my friend, my mentor, my teacher, who showed me traditional West African, and that's what felt like home. I'm a victim and a survivor of sexual exploitation. So during that time, I was being sexually exploited and I didn't know my value and I was losing myself and I didn't understand how I had this gift of dance, but I couldn't feel. I was somehow numb. And when traditional West African dance was placed on my body and I embodied that type of ancestral ritual, it created something new for me. And I wanted to spread that. I wanted everyone to feel what I felt. And most importantly, I wanted everyone to heal from their traumas and to see their value. Sometimes you have to break and get rid of all that extra gunk. And then you pick up the pieces that you find most valuable to yourself. breaking is just as important as mending. So you get to pick up those important pieces, and you get to do it while listening to music. You get to do it while closing your eyes and moving your body in a way that you have never moved before. It's just beautiful. And then how do you apply that movement or that feeling that you felt of breaking and mending into your daily life? I actually have a class at Northside Healing Space called Finding Your Divinity, and that is a very accessible space. The class is every Sunday, all bodies. I'm also fluent in sign language, so I welcome people who are of different abilities. And what we do is we dance, practice self-love, we do some meditation, and we do some writing prompts. It really feels like family. It's a very affirming space. I can make change not only in myself, like really change my heart and the chemicals in my body, and I can also change the world. I can change the way that I move, the way that I talk. Those spaces that I occupy in dance created that pathway for me. So it's more than just 5, 6, 7, 8.
KFAI's Dixie Trykle produced this audio portrait. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1600.